My guest Diane Fossey has spent 14 years in the mountains of Central Africa studying the behavior and communication patterns of mountain gorillas. These gorillas are threatened with extinction now. Some are being murdered by poachers who usually go unprosecuted. And the land that the gorillas live on is being encroached on by agriculturalists and cattle herders. Fossey started her fieldwork under the direction of Louis Leakey. She was an occupational therapist in 1963 when she urged him to sponsor her fieldwork. Well, Leakey said he would do it, but only if she had her appendix taken out, something he said she'd need to do as a medical precaution before working in Africa. Well, she did it, and after the operation, Leakey confessed that he was just testing her to see if she was committed enough to the fieldwork to undergo the surgery, but apparently the appendectomy was not necessary as a medical precaution. Since 1980, Diane Fossey has been teaching at universities in the States. She's been at Cornell and SUNY Plattsburgh in New York. Her book, Gorillas in the Mist, will soon be published by Houghton Mifflin. Her research has been the subject of numerous articles and a National Geographic film. She's in Philadelphia to speak this evening at the Academy of Natural Sciences. The slides and lecture will be at 8:15 this evening. She'll be speaking on the social structure of mountain gorillas. And if you'd like to call for more information, you can call 299-1047. That's 299-1047. Diane Fossey, welcome to Fresh Air. I think a lot of people are really captivated by gorillas and monkeys also, in part because a lot of people feel this bond to them. It's not quite like looking at yourself. It's like looking at yourself, but very different. Did you feel that connection at all?
Well, when I look at a gorilla, I feel like I'm looking at the better half of myself.
Really?
There's a gentle, regal, magnificent air about a gorilla that I have not seen in any other animal as yet.
Did you know that you'd feel that connection towards them before you went into the field?
Yes, you only have to look into the huge, soft brown eyes of a gorilla, even one in captivity at times, if they're in a good captive setting, and there's a sense of communication, of rapport. And, of course, when I went to the field at first in 1963 and saw my first free-living gorilla, I felt a very strong emotional attachment, and I knew that I'd have to go back and study them.
So when you asked Leakey if he'd sponsor your research, he told you to get your appendix out?
Yes, he was very wise in telling me to get my appendix out, really, because in a very remote setting on top of a mountain, in the midst of a mountain rainforest, and you've got to, the nearest hospital is about 4 hours away, and you've got to climb in and out of this mountain setting. So if you have appendicitis, you're pretty much imperiled. So I was very lucky that he decided mine should go.
Well, so that was one less medical problem for you to worry about. But do you ever resent him, though, for having had to do this unnecessary medical procedure just to prove yourself?
No, I think Dr. Leakey probably put off a lot of candidates for this job by having them have their appendix, or asking to have their appendix out. A lot of people weren't really willing to go through this. I, for one, am glad I did it, and I do appreciate his sense of humor.
That's a nice way of putting it. What have the questions been that have been framing your research in the field?
Well, I wanted to know how the gorilla is structured. Do they live singly, or what makes a gorilla tick, in so many words? And I came to know that gorillas live in very cohesive familial units that are bonded by very strong kinship ties. And each group is headed by a silverback male, that's a male over the age of 13, whose back hair is silvered with advancing age, just like many grandfathers' hair is silvered by advancing age. This is the dominant leader of the group, and his females are ordinarily bonded to him for life. And the group is so cohesive in nature, the young, therefore, have a chance to grow up knowing their peers and siblings for about the first 8 years of their lives. If there are no breeding opportunities within any gorilla group, then the males will leave and go out to find females from other groups to establish their own harem. That's also if there are no breeding opportunities in a group for a young female, she will be taken by another silverback. So this enhances her status as she goes to another silverback, especially if she's the first acquired, and it also functions for exogamy, or outbreeding.
Where do you watch all of this from?
Well, I've established my camp in the Parc des Volcans, which is part of the Virunga mountain range in Rwanda. There are only 375 square kilometers left of protected land within the Virungas, which are shared by Zaire, Rwanda, and Uganda. And this is the last stronghold and the only location where there are mountain gorilla. There are now 242 mountain gorilla remaining.
That's all?
That's all. 22 years ago, when George Schaller, he was an American scientist, he was the very first to conduct any type of long-term study of gorillas. He estimated between 400 to 500 gorillas remaining within the Virungas. So as you can see, in a 22-year period, there's been a 50% reduction in the population.
What are some of the reasons why the population is shrinking?
The population of mountain gorilla is shrinking because of land encroachment. People, particularly in Rwanda, need more land for cultivation. So they've taken out 40% of the park within Rwanda for the purpose of cultivation of tobacco and pyrethrum and beans. Pyrethrum is a natural insecticide. Gorilla population, so this is therefore squeeze the groups into overlapping ranges, not giving them enough range. Well, they should have a range of at least 10 square kilometers, but when they're squeezed into these overlapping ranges, there are numerous interactions between groups, which hinder breeding because the animals are not, you know, having a normal, calm day routine. They have to worry about interacting with other animals. There's also, of course, the most violent threat to the gorilla are the poachers. The poachers are Africans only, who many years ago killed silverback males for their heads, their ears, their small fingers, and their testicles, and they ground up some of these parts into a concoction which was designed to give the recipient the strength and virility of a silverback male. This practice, black magic type of practice, is no longer believed in by the Africans, so it's declined for a short period of time. Poachers were killing gorillas for their skulls, for their heads, their hands, for ashtrays, for the tourist trade. That only went on for a short period, because there was one very fine Rwandese, Mr. Pauline Nkubili, who was the substitute or the sheriff of a small town near the mountains, who fined anyone, black or white, who was connected with the killing to obtain skulls. In fact, he fined the European director of the French hospital $2,000 for possessing a silverback skull, and the director left the country rather than pay the fine. Now, the third reason for gorillas being killed, they kill to capture young for zoos, even though there's a total embargo on gorilla in America. There are other countries, such as Belgium and Holland, which do still import, quite illegally actually, gorillas, but they're able to get by with it. Poachers kill gorilla for political gain. In other words, keep in mind, these are very poor countries that share this parkland. So if the death of one gorilla creates a great public stir, and vast amounts of money pour into these poor countries, then the death of two gorillas is going to create twice as much of a stir and also allow for twice as much money to come in. So right now, if I hear of a gorilla being killed, I will know that it's a reason. It's for political gain and for financial gain.
What money is this? Conservation money coming
That's
in?
That's conservation money coming in.
So, like,
it's not directed. You see, when
sounds like a real scam.
Yeah, that's why conservation efforts, of course, are fantastic, but they have to be directed. You can't just send thousands of dollars over to a park director and not see how and where it's going to be spent. So many conservation schemes, societies do have someone on the other end of the line who is helping to direct the flow of this money.
Do the gorillas seem to know that they're threatened with the possibility of extinction?
Well, I can't say that a gorilla has the forethought to say I'm threatened with extinction, but certainly the gorillas are very wary of the human encroachment. And for this reason, they spend a great deal of their time high in these steep mountains rather than in the flatter saddle, which at the altitude of 10,000 feet offers a great variety of vegetation and a great not only quantity but quality of vegetation. They can't afford to spend much time there because that is where they usually meet the poachers who are out for elephant or buffalo or setting traps.
So they're moving further up as years go by?
That's right. They have to move up higher where the vegetation is not as luxurious and really is just barely meeting their needs.
So you've spent about 14 years in the mountains in Central Africa studying the gorillas, also trying to save them when you can. My understanding is that to get as close to them as possible without them being fearful of you, you started to try to learn communication patterns of gorillas so that you could, in whatever way you could, be like them, so you could best blend in. Why did you think that that would be effective?
Well, I wanted to communicate with the gorillas, so it was essential that I learn their means of communication. And the gorillas are so shy and so gentle, so one had to be very submissive. In other words, you don't go just stomping right up to them and stand up and make yourself conspicuous. You crawl to them and to elicit their curiosity. In the initial days, I kept myself somewhat obscured by vegetation and let them climb into the trees to see me. And I put vines over my binoculars so that they didn't look like two staring eyes. I usually had my arms crossed or scratched myself slowly or pretended to munch on their vegetation. And again, keep in mind, the gorillas only knew humans as poachers, so it took about 2 years before I could get the gorillas to at least halt and not flee upon first seeing me. And I did something rather ridiculous in the first 6 months. Gorillas chest beat when they're alarmed. They have a very powerful chest beat. And
kind of like the Tarzan type thing?
Yeah, that's right. So when in the first couple months the gorillas did see me coming, the male, usually the adult male, would sound an alarming chest beat, a pock, 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 which I could possibly do, but I tried to imitate this chest beat, thinking I was terribly clever. And, of course, the gorillas never seen a human being chest beat, and it did provoke their curiosity somewhat. But what was I doing? In essence, I was telling the gorillas that I'm alarmed, too. So then naturally they chest beat back to say, well, we're doubly alarmed now because you're alarmed. So then I learned that I had to imitate their contentment vocalizations. And the most common of these is what I have termed the belch vocalization. And that's a very soothing mwah, 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 mwah. And I could see that this was really the ticket to my entry into gorilla land, because they were quite amazed that a human would sit there and give belch vocalizations. So I've been belching ever since.
So would they come up to you and
No, they'd hold their, they'd learn to hold their ground then, Terry, because they, here was a human that sat there and scratched and munched on food and belched. So this was obviously nothing that they needed to be afraid of.
Were there other sounds that you learned to do?
Yes. The belch vocalization I use the most, but when the little ones now, say the ones under the age of four, are crawling all over me or pulling my hair or trying to take my binoculars or water jug away, I give the disciplinary vocalization that the parents give to tell Junior to shape up if he gets too rough. And that's what I have termed a pig grunt. And that's just a and it does stop the little ones from pulling my hair, etc. But by far, my favorite is the belch vocalization. And I'm afraid I've taken to liking it so much that even in society, if I'm stumped to the answer of a question or if I disagree mildly with something, instead of giving a retort, I just go, "Mom." It'd be a wonderful world if all of us went around doing that when we were going to have a squabble with someone.
Well, I keep thinking how odd it must be for you to have spent 14 years learning to blend in with gorillas, then come back and end up teaching at Cornell, you know, where behavior patterns are very different. And, you know, I mean, you're fitting into the Ivy League academic world. It must have been really disorienting.
Oh, I'm kind of a unique teacher. Well, I just love the students. They're so enthusiastic, both at Cornell and Plattsburgh. And it was just such fun to be able to share the findings of the field. This was a comparative behavior of the three great apes. We had to include orangutan and chimpanzees as well as gorilla, because that made the behavior of each genera more meaningful when you could compare the three different orang, chimp, gorilla. But of course, my favorite was pretty obvious what that was. So we'd rush through all the material on the orangutan and the chimp, and then we'd spend the rest of the class session with gorilla. It was such fun. The students were wonderful.
Well, let's get back to the gorillas that you studied in Africa. You keep talking about them as being very, very gentle. Did you ever feel endangered by them in the years that you'd follow them and watch them?
No, I never, truthfully, could feel endangered by a gorilla. There's just, if someone is stupid, and I have seen about four people, I've known of about four cases where people went to the gorillas too rapidly. They didn't announce their approach. They came from a downhill position working with the gorillas above them. And these are essentially very egotistical people, I might add. One person even wanted to pick up a baby. And each of these four persons were very badly bitten, but they had only themselves to blame. And the observer must always remember that he or she is an intruder into the domain of a wild animal, and that the rights of that animal supersede those of his or her own. And you've got to respect the rights of the animal, and you should never be in any trouble.
You've described a bit what kind of groups the gorillas travel in, and you said that there's a silver-backed male who's usually the leader of the group. How much of the group's behavior and travel patterns is determined by the leader? Like, what exactly does the leader lead in?
The silverback male determines the speed and the direction in which the group will travel. The silverback male determines when they're going to stop for their day nest. They travel, and when they're going to stop for their night nest and exactly where it's going to be. They spend about 30% of their day travel feeding, you know, munching as they walk along, and they spend about 40% of their day resting, especially when it's nice and sunny and warm, which is a rare day. And it's the silverback who will also settle disputes among the females of his group, if females do like to bicker, and he will just and get right in between the two females, and they'll instantly stop and go their separate ways. The silverback, if you might think on this a minute, he is silvered. And, you know, the females and the others don't become silvered, even with age. It's only the dominant leader. And, of course, that big white back of his shows up as a signaling function throughout this very deep, dense vegetation. And let's face it, if females all also had silverbacks as they matured, there'd be a tremendous confusion of signals. So as it stands, it's only the silverback. Also, the silverbacks are the only ones that are able to emit this very strong odor. It's overpowering. Just think of yourself maybe a couple of months without a bath and having done a lot of heavy work. You understand the odor that you will be putting out. The silverback can disseminate this odor from his axillary region, and he will do that as a silent means of communication when danger threatens. If a gorilla group is in the forest, and just use this for an example, and they hear poacher dogs way off in the distance, maybe a kilometer away, the silverback can emit this pungent odor, and immediately all those that are scattered around him feeding, the other gorillas of his group, will cloister to him and they'll flee in the opposite direction in which the dogs are coming. Now, that's a silent signal. It's a very effective one because by communicating in that manner, they're not giving away their location to the dogs. The dogs may ultimately get there, but they're not going to get there as fast as they would had the silverback vocalized.
The dogs don't pick up on the smell?
Oh, sure, but that's when they get there, though. Keep in mind, they may not even go there because they haven't been cued in by a vocalization. And, of course, they pick up on the smell, but by then, the gorillas have had a chance to put some space in between them and the dogs.
So do the temperament of different leader gorillas differ widely?
Yes. The older, more experienced silverbacks have, obviously, calmer, more secure groups. Everyone knows their place. A new silverback who's just forming a group can be a little bit skittish. And even a very experienced silverback will always be a little bit more nervous on the days when one of his females gives birth.
What are the differences between the way the male gorillas and the female gorillas spend their typical day?
Well, their time schedule is pretty much the same. Females, when they're pregnant, however, tend to do a tremendous amount of eating. But you see, the silverback can just lie in the sun while his harem, or those pregnant ones, are feeding right in the immediate area. And they really don't have too much difference in how they spend their day. The mothers spend more time, naturally, with their young, up to the age of about 2, and then an infant about 2 years of age is frolicking around its father or with the other young of the group.
When you were watching the gorillas, did you ever say to yourself, what does this mean about behavior patterns of male and female people?
I forgot about people whilst I was with the gorillas, quite frankly. And I only went to study gorillas' behavior patterns. And it seemed to me it's the cohesiveness of the gorilla group that we as humans could learn to apply to our own family units. And it's the great, even altruism is seen among gorilla leaders, then that they will give their lives so that their young when their young are threatened by danger, there's this just sense of unity in the gorilla family group that's unique among non-human primates and possibly unique among all primates.
Where did you live?
In the old days, when the road never even went near the mountains, so one would have a 5-hour walk to get up to the 10,000-foot saddle area in which I settled my camp. But now one starts at the base of Mount Busoki, which is in the Parc des Volcans of Rwanda, at 8,600 feet, and then you climb for 2 hours on a little muddy ribbon of a trail used essentially by now porters. It used to be used by elephant and buffalo commonly. And then I settled my camp at 10,000 feet in a meadow beautiful forested meadow area that looks like rather English parkland, of huge old aganya trees and dripping moss and lichen and vines, and crossed by fresh running streams, beautiful things, and it's silhouetted by two, three extinct volcanoes that go up to 16,000 feet. So I snuck my little camp right against Mount Busoki, which is only 12,700 feet. And initially I had two tents, one for myself and one for my Africans. But because of the inclement rainfall, it averages 72 inches a year, my tent began looking somewhat like a Chinese laundry. So we started building cabins, and now there are eight such small cabins on the meadow. They're hidden, most of them behind thickets of trees and whatnot, so that we don't do an injustice to the beauty of the country around us. And through these cabins have passed several dozen students over the past 14 years, all of who have really had the unique privilege of coming to know the mountain gorilla.
Did you make any return trips during those 14 years, or were you there constantly?
Well, Terry, I didn't like to leave camp very much, so I came out far less than most people do who have field work in Africa. I came out about four times, I guess, and stayed as briefly as I could to get my teeth glued together and my bones glued together and all that, and eat and eat and eat and get new clothing and equipment, and then rush back to camp.
What would you miss during the times when...
What did I miss?
If there were times when you missed... things.
Well, at the end of a two-year period, when I'd been at camp, I literally dreamed about food all night long. I dreamed about Big Macs. I dreamed about fried chicken. Oh, junky food. Oh, sirloin steaks, anything. I really dreamed, and I dreamed about going to Kmart's at dawn with a great, great shopping basket and going up one aisle, filling it up with everything I could find, and then getting another shopping basket. This is Kmart's. And just piling them all up. Oh, that was such fun. But I dreamed about these things every night. And I'd wake up, you know, to find myself reaching out for something, and there I was at camp. It was a strange feeling. But it was so much fun to return to camp with new things for the Africans and new gimmicks and to help make the work and research easier.
How do you feel about zoos?
Well, there are zoos and there are zoos. And you can't, a person cannot generalize and say all zoos are bad. And I think zoos are trying very hard to improve the situation of the captives, not only gorillas, but all species. And let's just say they're trying very hard and they're starting a process of exchange, which is true in the wild. Females are exchanged between groups. So now they're doing it in captivity, too, to improve the breeding status of gorillas in captivity.
Do you ever go to zoos and communicate with the gorillas there?
Yep. Let's put it this way. I'm invited to a lot of zoos. So whenever I am invited to a zoo, I try and get in the corner where there aren't any humans around with the gorilla, and and they're so interested, even the ones that were born in captivity. And they just sit there and they'll look so questioningly and so they're truly interested and curious. What is the sound? Don't they know it?
Oh, so the ones in captivity don't do that?
Some don't, no.
Because they haven't been taught?
They haven't had an imitation experience, right? Unless they've been brought up with their parents, and then they can learn from their parents. But you take an isolated animal, it doesn't really know what a mom is.
Oh, so interesting that you'd know it and that they wouldn't.
Yeah, it's sad.
What are some of the other differences between the mountain gorillas and the ones brought up in captivity?
Oh, well, most of the animals in captivity are lowland gorillas. In fact, there are no mountain gorillas in captivity at all. And they're about lowland gorillas have 29 morphological differences. Mountain gorillas are adapted to high altitudes. Mountain gorillas are more terrestrial. Lowland gorillas, which are only on the west coast of Africa, there are about 9,000 to 10,000 of those still remaining in the wild. And they're more arboreal and frugivorous. Like I say, they're the only ones you see in zoos.
Well, when you got your start doing this in 63, as we mentioned before, Louis Leakey said, well, you'll have to get your appendix out. And he did that just to test you, to see how willing you were to go out of your way to do something just to be able to study the gorillas. Would you ever do a similar test for someone who wanted to study under your sponsorship?
Well, that's a very good question. I've never been asked that question before. I wonder if that might not be such a bad idea, because sometimes on this side of the ocean, everyone says, oh, potential students, they are really anxious to do anything in the world to get over there. And I'm very gullible. I buy it. And, well, we've had something like the 4-day wonder, the 2-day wonder. So it's, you can't really decide how someone's going to work out between America and sitting 10,000 feet on that mountain with mist and the gorillas around.
Well, Diane Fossey, I want to thank you very much for telling us a little bit about what you've been doing over the past over 14 years. Thanks very much for talking with us.